Okay. One of the first philosophers to entertain the possibility that there are many solar systems is Giordano Bruno, who in 1600 was burned alive for his beliefs. Recently, there is a large number of cosmologists that are entertaining the possibility of many universes. Punishment for them is much less severe. So it really, the modern version of anthropics started in the British School of Astrophysics, and there is a whole book by Barrow and Tipler summarizing some of the developments until the mid-80s. Then there was interest regarding the addressing the cosmological constant problem using anthropic reasoning. And recently there has been a flurry of activity in several places. And we've heard several talks and we'll hear even more. I'm going to be talking about some work in progress with Nima Arkani Hamed and Matthias Aldariaga, as well as some work that is finished with Scott Thomas. So in the beginning, I start with a relatively broad overview of the subject. So why are we discussing the anthropic principle? Perhaps the best reason is that it is the only successful approach to the cosmological constant problem, actually to both cosmological constant problems, the extreme smallness of it, as well as the magnitude of the cosmological constant itself. However, if it is a good principle, we should not just apply it when we are desperate. It should have a broader range of applicability. In particular, we should entertain the possibility of applying it to problems for which there are standard explanations. Perhaps we should apply it to the gauge hierarchy problem, for example, instead of SUSY as an alternative approach. Okay? Perhaps we should apply it to fermion masses and many of the other problems of the parameters of the standard model. A general warning, historic warning, there is one of the earliest applications of the anthropic principle happened at the very beginning of this century by a Harvard biologist called Lawrence J. Henderson, who wrote a book with this title. His main thesis was an anti-Darwinian approach. Instead of biology adapting to physics, his thesis was that physics may have to adapt to biology, and he was able to predict many of the properties of the periodic table by such arguments. Any of you who don't already know the answer want to guess when that book came out? The answer is about as interesting as it could be. It came out in 1913, the same year that Niels Bohr wrote his theory of atoms. So you can imagine if Niels Bohr had read this book and was young and impressionable, philosophically inclined person, he might have just believed it and not developed further. So there is a... This underlines the fear that anybody engaged in anthropics must have, and this is the fear of premature application. In other words, if you apply the principle too quickly, you miss all the fun. So you should make sure you apply it only to a fundamental theory, not to an effective theory. And of course, it's hard to know sometimes beforehand when we are dealing with a fundamental theory and when with an effective theory. Furthermore, we should favor theories which produce naturally a multiverse within themselves. Okay, here is a...
So you're saying
I think, yeah, what I was saying is that it is good to apply it to a theory which is known by within itself to produce a multiverse or multivac. Okay.
There's so many things that I can solve, by the way, I have a theory that predicts one universe.
Then it would be hard to apply.
You say, go away, I want to do that stuff.
If that one universe predicts all the parameters of the standard model, my choice will be clear, yeah. Okay, so here is the outline. First, I will just discuss the methodology of anthropic reasoning. Then I will have very little time to talk about the second part, but several others will talk about it. Probably Linda and Vilenkin will talk more about this. And finally, I'll talk about some work that's still very much under development on a relation between cosmological constant and gauge hierarchy problems. So the methodology of anthropic reasoning, useful analogy, start with the pre-Keplerian picture of the universe. Here is the universe, a bunch of nested Platonic solids. And this was a good theory. It explained the most important numbers of the whole universe, namely the distances of the six planets from each other. In terms of some golden ratios, the square root of 3 and the cube root of 2, etc., in terms of Platonic solids. It was very good. All of these distances are about 10% or better of their actual value. So you had 5 numbers better than 10%. This is even more impressive than gauge coupling unification, supersymmetric theories. So it was really hard for Kepler to give up. So in Kepler's view, Kepler would be very disappointed with Newton's theory. It would look like Newton's theory is giving up. It's giving up on the most fundamental quantities of physics, and it reduces them to historical accidents. Now, some predictivity can be recovered, can be maintained with respect to our own solar system, that is, if you adopt the following principles. First of all, if there are many planets, if habitable planets must contain water, okay, so if you postulate this habitability criteria, that they must contain liquid water, and furthermore, if you postulate that we live in a typical habitable planet, then you can predict the Earth's sun distance given these three things, provided that the Earth is a typical habitable planet. Okay? So that's standard reasoning. Now I want to emphasize how important it is to apply this anthropic reasoning, how important it is for requirement 3 to be met, namely that we live in a typical habitable planet. Imagine that the Earth was an atypical habitable planet. Okay? So here is the Earth, and we happen by sheer chance to be living around the star that is surrounded by a parabolic mirror, which happens to be rotating at the same angular velocity with the Earth. Now, this would be an atypical situation in which we lose the capacity to predict the Earth's sun distance by the requirement of the existence of liquid water. Okay? And we lose other predictions. For example, auroras will not be typical in such an Earth. Okay? So the conclusion is that when we are in an atypical part, a typical planet or a typical sample, the average properties of the average planets are irrelevant for us. Okay? So in this case, we either need providence to explain what is going on, or we are missing some very important dynamics, the dynamics that miraculously may give rise to such parabolic mirrors with all the right properties. It's clear we have to move beyond the properties of averages. Okay, with this warning in mind, let us now underline the general methodology of the anthropic principle as it is used today. So we replace a planet by the universe. So we repeat the following statements. There are many universes, okay, called multiverse. Habitable universes require property X is the second hypothesis. And third is that our universe is a typical habitable universe. Okay. So under this 1, 2, 3 assumptions, in some cases, we'll be able to predict some property Y in our universe. All right. Now, if this works, then we declare victory for the anthropic reasoning. If it doesn't work, we say, oh, there must be missing dynamics that needs to be understood. Now, an enormous number of debates focuses on what we mean by X. Different people think different X's are natural. Different habitability properties are natural. Okay? So let me give you an example, examples of various habitability criteria and what they predict. Yes.
Wasn't there an important point missing from that list, which is that at least one of those universes have to contain X in the multiverse? And that's usually a non-trivial issue when you actually try to apply.
That's true. I didn't state it right. At least you said at least
one.
At least one must contain X. Yes. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So here are examples of X galaxies. Okay. So the requirement, one requirement that several people have used is that the habitable universe must contain galaxies, and then this is the this can lead to a prediction Y, whereby you conclude that the vacuum energy has to be about 100 times less than its observed value. Now, this is a relatively weak requirement. Most people think that this is a relatively weak requirement for the existence of complex structures, life. So that's one criterion, and has led to a successful prediction. Second requirement possibility, you can require that X contains hydrogen as well as heavy atoms. That also looks reasonable. It's a perhaps slightly stronger requirement, and that gives rise to predictions on some combinations of the up quark mass, the down quark mass, and lambda QCD. Third requirement, these are becoming somewhat stronger as we go down the line, that the universe contains carbon. Okay, that is fairly stringent. It predetermines to within a few percent some combinations of some Sandar model quantities. Okay. Now, all of these are well-known examples. Yeah, you need that. I didn't list everything. Actually, you do need the electroweak scale, because the electroweak scale enters in MU and MD. Right. Now let's, so all of these you can call successes of anthropic reasoning. Here is a well-known failure. Let X be the requirement of longevity of the proton, okay? Now from the requirement that protons do not decay in our bodies and fry us, you can deduce a limit that the proton lifetime is longer than 10 to the 16 years. This is a famous limit Goldhaber, Maurice Goldhaber, likes to refer to it as follows. He says, we know in our bones that proton lifetime is longer than 10 to the 16 years. Okay? Now, this anthropic reasoning fails. Why? Because the proton lifetime is, in fact, 16 orders of magnitude longer than it needs to be to avoid frying our bones. Okay? So because it's so much longer than it needs to be for our safety, we say that the anthropic reasoning fails and that we need either symmetry or dynamics to understand the longevity of the proton. I want to mention something. This is an example which is like an implicit hypothesis when we use the anthropic principle, is that we live relatively dangerously. What I mean by that is if the proton lifetime turned out to be, let's say, 10 to the 17 years, we might argue that this may be anthropic, maybe 10 to the 18. The fact that it is much longer than that suggests that there is another principle at work. So if we don't live dangerously, if we live too safely, then the anthropic reasoning fails and we need some additional dynamics or symmetries to understand it. And the same goes for the vacuum energy. If the vacuum energy was measured to be a trillion times smaller than this upper limit, then we would no longer believe in the anthropic reasoning. We would look for some dynamics. Okay, so this is an example of relative successes and a failure of this type of reasoning. Now, I'm not going to either have time or there is no need in this audience to discuss possibilities for multiverse. One is the discretum that has already been discussed and will be discussed further. And this is some sort of one-dimensional picture of the landscape. The second comes from André Linde. Both the figure and the theory comes from André Linde. This is a picture of chaotic multiverse. Each one of these balloons is a universe, and the whole thing, which is much, much bigger, is the multiverse. Contains many, many universes, and color coding signifies that they have different properties. Okay, so much for the methodology of the anthropic principle. Now I want to rapidly move to some questions and applications that often come up, but I really don't have time to discuss them in detail, so I will just go rapidly. So, anthropic reasoning, is it predictive? I think it's fair to say yes. The vacuum energy is an example. Another example I want to be to point out is that the time dependence of the vacuum energy can also be anthropically predicted in a big class of theories. In one class of theories, it's just constant. The equation of state is W is always minus one. The equation of state is P minus rho. But in a whole big class of theories, the vacuum energy has a well-defined time dependence, and I will just flash this time dependence that will be measured in the future by, for example, the SNAP satellite. Okay, so this is the magnitude of a supernova as a function of Z, and in a big class of theories, you can predict that it will have to lie on some very well-defined lines. And in fact, the principle of living dangerously suggests that it should be somewhere here or here, somewhere between 2 and 3. If you don't live dangerously, it could be somewhere here. Okay, this you'll probably hear more about this from Vilenkin's talk. So, another example of application that I already alluded to, and Tom already alluded to, is that it can, of course, be also applied to the electroweak VEV. If you can blindly apply to the hierarchy problem and suggest that the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs is just anthropic, the simplest way, there are many arguments for that, the simplest way to argue it is through the existence of atoms. Okay? So the existence, for example, of here is the neutron minus proton minus the electron mass. The existence of atoms relies sensitively on a coincidence that the neutron-proton mass difference, the electron mass, the electromagnetic self-energy of nuclei, as well as their binding energy, are all within an order of magnitude of each other. So as you crank up, for example, the weak vacuum expectation value that Tom was asking about before, what happens is the neutron-proton mass difference increases. When it exceeds about 8 MeV, then heavy nuclei start decaying. Conversely, as the weak VEV decreases, the neutron-proton mass difference drops. Eventually, electron in a hydrogen atom gets captured by a proton and gets converted to a neutron plus neutrino, so you lose hydrogen. So as you crank up the VEV, you lose heavy nuclei, you crank down, you lose hydrogen. And of course, there are much more precise. This roughly constrains the weak vacuum expectation value variation within factors of few, you can get much more precise constraint if you consider more detailed process, the burning of the sun, the production of deuterium in the Big Bang. And the most famous of all, and most precise of all, is Hoyle and Salpeter's argument about carbon. Carbon has to be made in red giants. It has to be made in a hurry because it's made out of a highly unstable nucleus. And once it is made, it's highly susceptible to being converted to oxygen, which lies dangerously close. So as you change parameters of the standard model, you either don't make carbon or you burn it to oxygen. And since this is the only place where you can make it in any abundance, that's dangerous. So that constrains parameters to within percent. Okay. Last point that's often discussed. Let me skip some point. So do we have to keep up some of the successes of our standard theory, such as supersymmetric grand unification? It would be a shame if we had to do that. So I just want to mention a possible philosophy in which you don't have to. And here is a simple way you can keep the predictions of SUSY grand unification and also allow yourself to argue anthropically. So remember, in supersymmetric grand unified theories, there is two distinct scales, the grand unification and the Planck mass. And these theories are fairly successful when it comes to predicting large numbers. By large, I mean order one. Okay? For example, gauge coupling unification works to within percent accuracies. Also, large Yukawa coupling, such as the top Yukawa coupling, comes nicely from a fixed point. Bottom Tau-mass relation comes out from SU5. So these numbers work fairly well. And they also have the feature that because they are large, they are not very sensitive to Planckian corrections. Okay. Now, the light quark masses, by contrast, for example, the up or the down or the electron mass, are very small, and they are enormously sensitive to Planck suppressed to Planck slope or Planck suppressed operators. So, if we could have a framework in which all the Planck suppressed operators, the coefficients of the Planck suppressed operators, are dependent, changed from multiverse to multiverse, then we could plausibly then use anthropics to determine the values of the light quark masses on which our life depends quite sensitively, yet determine by symmetry arguments or familiar renormalization group arguments all the large parameters on which we are less sensitive. So this is just an example of how things might work where you wouldn't have to give up everything. And now I want to switch to the last part of my talk, which is anthropic relation between the cosmological constant and hierarchy problems. Okay. One of the big mysteries that many of us have been thinking about for a very long time and not very successfully is the following. There are two famous problems, the hierarchy problem, which is the disparity of the weak and Planck scale, and the cosmological constant problem, disparity of the vacuum energy and the weak interaction scale. And it turns out that these two disparities are equal logarithmically. So the vacuum energy, weak scale, and Planck mass are all equidistant, okay, as expressed by this equation. Okay, this has been a mystery for a long time, and many of us have thought that it may be deep. This was part of the motivation for the large extra dimension scenario. Tom has thought a lot about this relation. And many of us have thought that this may be telling us something extremely deep. Here, I want to discuss a possible alternate point of view, that this relation may instead be of anthropic origin. And to use anthropic or multiverse reasoning, You have to, again, begin by deciding what is your habitability criterion. So the simplest habitability criterion on which people feel reasonably comfortable applying is that galaxies must form. So galaxies must form. Now, it's not too hard to argue that the condition for forming galaxies requires that the vacuum energy is related to the weak interaction scale and to the Planck mass by such a relation. This relation is derived in a broad class of models for which the dark matter particles or the dark matter particles are of the order of the weak interaction scale.
How does the weak interaction scale
of proton mass?
The weak interaction
scale is the mass of the dark matter particle. For example, such as in supersymmetric theories. Okay. That's an extra assumption. What? That's right. It could be, but in a broad class of theories, such as supersymmetric unified theories, they are identified.
If you use a graphic argument to make a prediction,
that's right.
You can
call it M dark. I don't care about the subscript, but in a broad class of theories, the dark matter mass is the scale of weak interactions, the scale of supersymmetry. Yeah, this is not true in all theories. It's true in a broad class of theories that we are working with. Okay. So.
But so, if you take the Shirley dark matter as a cluster mass particle, okay, everything fails here, right?
Everything fails?
Yeah, you can take it Shirley as a particle, a cluster mass particle.
This is not the only option for dark matter. First, dark matter particle may be different than, has a mass different than weak interaction scale. It may be the action, it may be Planck mass particle. I'm not in the context of a large class of theories. Okay?
Would this rule out an axiom
dark matter? No. No. Now, let me go in more detail so you'll understand the assumptions. Okay? Okay. So the derivation of the previous result comes from the standard calculation of how dark matter abundance depends on the mass of the dark matter particle, M. So there is three familiar era. There is the decoupling era, then there is matter radiation equality, and the important point is that the temperature at matter radiation equality scales like the mass square of the dark matter particle divided by M Planck. And then taking the law of growth of fluctuations as a function of time, you deduce that the density of galaxies, the density in the nonlinear regime, is given by this expression. Okay? So the requirement that when protogalaxies form, they are not exploded or they are not blown apart by vacuum energy requires that the vacuum energy must be less than this than the protogalaxy density from which you deduce the previous relation. Okay?
So less, not less. Sorry.
It's less. Now, why did I say, okay, it's less. Now, why do I emphasize equal? I emphasize equal again because of this principle of living dangerously. Okay? If it was much, much less, then you would look for some other principle. Okay? So this relation may not be deep, but may be anthropic. And in this class of theories, it reduces, instead of one, it reduces the two problems, the cosmological cost and the gauge hierarchy problem, to one. Now, here I have some more points that, I can clarify on why this factor may not be much different than unity. I can come to that in questions. I know that. But I actually, Yeah, I'm actually going to comment on it. Just to wait. Okay? So, that's right. Okay. So far, this is just a picture of what we have argued so far. So if you plot vacuum energy to the quarter power in Planck units and the weak interaction scale squared, the requirement of galaxy formation tells you that you should be along this line. However, so this this generates another question that I at least find extremely disturbing, which is the question of why do we live here? If you look at where we live like 10 to the minus 32 away from the origin in this plot, okay? It seems like we would, just on grounds of fine-tuning of the cosmological constant, we would be it would be enormously favored to live somewhere up here where all the mass scales are comparable, and then we wouldn't have to tune as much for the cosmological constant problem or the hierarchy problem, okay? So let us now try to imagine whether we could live in such a universe where the Planck mass, we could live in such a universe where this point moves up here towards its natural value of order one. Okay. To think about it, we can think about it in two equivalent ways. We can either imagine increasing the vacuum energy and the weak interaction scale, marching upwards like that, or perhaps it's more simple just think about keeping the vacuum energy and the weak interaction scale fixed and bring down the Planck mass. Okay? Just imagine bringing down the Planck mass. And ask yourself whether clearly doing that would tremendously be favored by the cosmological constant problem. Every time you bring the Planck mass by a factor of 10, you gain by 10 to the 4th. So there may be 10 to the 4 more universes in which to have complex structures in. Okay, so galaxies per se don't tell you where you should be along this line. So, as it often happens with anthropics, when the simplest criterion doesn't work, you just tighten it. Okay? So let's tighten it and insist that you form stars. Okay, so this is the habitability criterion. Age, now you insist that you must form stars. So imagine that you crank down the Planck mass and ask the question, can you still form stars? And you can still form stars. In fact, the criterion for forming stars is that after protogalaxies form, the cooling timescale of a local cloud has to be faster than the gravitational timescale of the problem, and that condition is satisfied as you crank down M Planck.
When you change Planck mass, you mean that you do it because of gravitational constant or Planck constant?
G Newton. G Newton. Just G Newton. G Newton goes up. Okay? Okay. So you can still form stars now these stars, now the lifetime of a star turns out scales as the lifetime of the longest lived stars scales like M Planck squared. So as you start dropping M Planck, the lifetime of a star, of the stars, typical lifetimes of stars will start dropping. So you might worry if you drop, let's say, M Planck by 4 orders of magnitude or 2 orders of magnitude, you might worry that stars don't live long enough for complex structures to evolve.
What else enters in that time?
It enters. The M over M star, where M star is a characteristic mass.
Yeah, I mean, but right. Does it only depend on MW? That's the question.
MW? No, it depends on M Planck.
No, but there should be other scales, right?
Yeah, there are. It's so M over M star. And however, the other scales...
Then M star depends on MW or what? You see? No. You are keeping MW fixed.
M star is the typical mass of a star, which is like M Planck cube or M prompton squared. So I'm keeping... everything
all
else.
Lambda QCD fixed.
That's right. I'm keeping everything fixed, okay. And just dropping M Planck. Yeah. Okay. I'm keeping everything fixed. You can get, I'm keeping baryon asymmetry, delta rho over rho. I'm varying only one thing. Take our universe and just imagine dropping M Planck, or you can imagine pushing all the mass scales. Okay? You can have a much, okay, you can make a much stronger argument for what I want to argue if you allow yourself to vary eta, for example, or delta rho over rho. And, not quite. I will tell you. I could for this argument. There is something that I'm not okay. The mass of a galaxy. Then you may start. If you want to keep all the successes, let's say, of gauge coupling unification and the Rahn renormalization group running, you may start conflicting with such things. Okay. So. I'm actually going to only be discussing moderate reductions of M Planck by factors up to 1,000, let's say. Okay. So star lifetime gets shorter. Still, you can live near a low mass star. Low mass stars, which are like a tenth of the solar mass, live very long. And even if you drop M Planck by a factor of 100, they live as long as 10 billion years, plenty of time. You get many more supernovae. The lifetime of or the typical lifetimes of all stars will be faster, but you are very far from being zapped because our universe today is extremely dilute. Okay, it's true that the stellar timescales are faster, so you form heavy elements more efficiently, but you are not at the limit at the level of being zapped by them. Yeah. Okay. So, okay. Very good. That's plenty. Okay. So, one possibility, if you tighten habitability criteria, is that we live near a star, but it's a low mass star, and because it's low mass, it lives much longer than it would normally live in our universe, and therefore it will live adequately long in a universe with a smaller M Planck. Furthermore, living near a star may even be unnecessary. For example, we can live on what you may term lonely planet, a planet far away from stars, okay, which is heated, for example, radioactively, such as the Earth. Okay. And that's one possibility. Another possibility is that if you can live near an object that is heated by tidal deformations, such as the Europa. Okay. Now, in both such environments, we have strong, for example, for the case of the Earth, we know that there are organisms that live, the so-called thermophiles, that live at deep sea vents, that some biologists claim may even be the ancestors to all life. So living on a radioactively heated planet is definitely an open possibility. Another, of course, equally open possibility is that you can live inside Europa, where Europa has ice outside and water inside, and it's heated by tidal deformations, deformations through the tidal forces that its neighbors exert on it. So. You can imagine a world where M Planck is significantly smaller than its normal value, where you have environments that would not be too different than ours, either in a lonely planet or near a star that is a small mass star. And such universes would be favored at least on one count, namely that they have less of a cosmological constant fine-tuning. So the question then would be, why are we so atypical? Why do we live? Why is gravity so much weaker than it needs to be? As we learned from our previous discussion, when we find ourselves that we are very atypical, there is nothing wrong with being atypical. But it just means that you are missing some crucial dynamics, such as the proton lifetime. Anthropics per se by itself cannot lead to a prediction, such as in the case of proton lifetime, but you need more crucial ingredients. Now, what could these ingredients look like? They could look like many things. Here is a possibility. So, here are some possibilities. Okay. So, let rho be, there are two rhoes. So, rho is the density of states, which depends on the vacuum energy and, let's say, this dark matter or electroweak scale. So, now ideally, what we've been trying to do for many, many years is hopefully to find out that there is that our theories will uniquely predict the vacuum energy to be millielectron volt and the weak scale to be TeV. And then, of course, we wouldn't need any of this discussion, no need for anthropics. We could determine both of these things. Another possibility is perhaps, for reasons that we don't understand, there is the density of state peaks very, very sharply for a value of the weak interaction scale around the TeV. And if this is the case, then you can use anthropics to limit the vacuum energy. For example, the famous vacuum energy argument from the middle 80s is just assuming that the electroweak scale is fixed and then it gets a limit for the vacuum energy. So that could be another possibility. However, there are other possibilities that you can figure out once you know this correlation between the cosmological constant and the hierarchy problem. For example, you can have a density of states that goes like 1 over m squared, where m again is the mass or the dark matter particle scale, okay? So if rho goes like 1 over m squared, then the totality of all the vacua that have acceptable, that can form galaxies and therefore have vacuum energy less than mw squared over m Planck is given by such an integral, okay? And if rho is 1 over m squared, of course, such an integral gives you a constant value. So in such a scenario, every value of the weak interaction scale would be equally preferred. And then if the weak interaction scale is gotten by dimensional transmutation, then every decade of energy of the weak interaction scale would be equally preferred. Other possibilities you can write down, it's now easy to write down. Once you know the correlation, once you know what the upper limit of this integral must be, then it's easy to write down more general functions that can accomplish the same. Here is one. Okay, so if the density of states is given by such a function where f and g are just, let's say, polynomials that don't involve exponentials, then it's easy to see, okay, I'm finished, that the number of that this n as a function of mw is not quite constant, but it's only logarithmically dependent on this mass scale. And therefore, again, you can use dimensional transmutation to argue that you have equal probability per decade for any value of the weak interaction scale. Now, trying to deduce such formula for rho demands a huge amount of dynamics. And however, it recasts the cosmological constant and the gauge hierarchy problems in a new form, the form being, you know, derived theories, find theories where the landscape or the density of states is a function like this, as a function of the cosmological constant and the weak interaction scale. Now, this task is enormous, okay? So the conclusion is, I'm totally out of time. The conclusion is that the multiverse may relate parameters, reducing the number of independent problems, and we saw that very clearly in the context of, in a class of theories, in the context of cosmological constant gauge hierarchy problems. It recasts all problems in new forms and broadens possible approaches, for example, now you can search for densities of states that are not just delta functions of the weak interaction scale, but they have more general functional forms. But of course, the challenges for these novel approaches are enormous, and I don't know the time scale for making real progress on this. So the message is, as always, back to work.
Okay, thank you for that provocative talk. We'll start with Willie.
But there is a parameter in QED that we don't talk much about, and it's theta QED.
Say that again. It's a parameter in QED.
There's a parameter in the theory of QED called theta QED, not theta QCD, theta QED, yeah, which we know nothing about.
Right, right.
Okay, so we could ask, oh, maybe we should try to determine it anthropically. In a way, that's probably not the case because we know nothing about it. It couldn't have affected anything about life.
Right.
And imagine that somebody measures it, okay, because he has a monopole in his pocket or something, okay, and it's a number between 0 and 2 pi. Are we supposed to try to find a theory that determines this parameter? This is supposed to be a fundamental parameter, at least at low energy it seems like a fundamental parameter. It's a coefficient of dimension 4 up. So, or should we just say, well, it's a random number, it doesn't matter, it's between 0 and 2 pi, it doesn't affect anything, so I don't care. But this kid has a monopole in his pocket. He says, this monopole is a dipole with a charge 0.27e. So I have to determine 0.27. So I have a philosophical question here. This is something we don't know how to measure. We don't know what its value is. Anthropically, it's not determined. It could be anything, right? Should I say c'est la vie? No, I cannot say c'est la vie because that's anthropic. Or should I waste my time to try to predict it and wait that the next generation somebody measures it and then I say, ha-ha, I had the right theory. There is a parameter that is as important.
So are you telling me there are parameters that are not determined by anthropic?
That's right.
QCD is another example.
Exactly, exactly. But theta QCD, we know it affects the dipole moment of the neutron, we have bounds on. Theta QED, we have zero.
Yes.
We know it's not determined anthropically.
Right.
Should I waste my time to try to build a theory to try to determine it? Or should I just leave it alone because it doesn't affect it?
So, by the way, one comment on this. This is not the only. There are parameters such as, for example, the tau lepton mass is highly non-anthropic. I mean, you could have a similar question before the tau was discovered.
Right.
The muon mass is fairly non-anthropic within limits. So there is a lot of parameters that are not anthropic. All the parameters, by the way, everything that carries color is in some sense anthropic, even the top quark mass, because changing it alone will change the Lambert QCD scale. So there are many parameters that are anthropic. This, the one that you're bringing up is the double whammy, that it's even hard to measure. Should you bother? I think if you do two things, number one, make a theory of it, number two, design an experiment to measure it, then the combination will be worthwhile.
Any further questions? Comments on?
Just a comment. In this kind of, you mentioned this nice point that in applications of the anthropic principle, you might imagine that there are some small quantities which, that certain small quantities would be anthropic because they would be subject to small variations in Planck scale operators. At least within this sort of discretum as it's been discussed, things don't look like they work that way. That nearby states which are anthropically acceptable, for example, from the standpoint of the cosmological constant or problem, are very different from one another.
You mentioned this recent TechMark paper, and you said you were going to say something about it.
Yeah, let's say something about it. Yeah. So what recent TechMark do is they try to argue that delta rho over rho has to be between delta rho over rho is minus 10 minus 5. And they claim that you can only change the exponent by 1 on each side. And I have problems with this for reasons that are related to what I have already said. For example, their argument for why you cannot make that this a little bigger, let's say 10 minus 4 or bigger, is that the density of galaxies, for each time you increase delta rho over rho by a factor of 10, the density of galaxy increases by delta rho over rho cubed by the formula that I showed. So the density of the galaxy is 1,000 times bigger.
That's keeping the cosmological constant.
Exactly.
So that's, you mean that actually it's primordial state from and then you
can... Exactly, this is the primordial...
But you assume also particular quantum for the unit.
You assume
only in
many
this
things.
Case it works. Forget about that.
Right.
Make everything from variables, okay? Make universe is only the smaller than one.
That's right.
Okay, and
yes. Absolutely.
So you don't predict anything.
Absolutely. There is also having a more dense galactic environment. Our galaxy has a big range of densities as you move from inside to outside. If there is a possibility that you just migrate to a less dense place where the density is as it is with us today and you maintain stability of planetary orbits, that's the argument we are worried about. Then, of course, there's a possibility that you don't even need to be on a planetary orbit. You can be in a longer planet. So now the argument for why delta rho over rho is cannot be much less, I think is more believable, because you get very cold. The proto-galaxy will be so cold that collisions, it will be hard for the clouds, the cooling time will be very long, because collisions, it will be much less efficient way to lose energy to collisions.
Okay, thanks, Simon. Thanks, Savas, again.